Ladies and gentlemen, I would just say, in addition to what Kathleen Rains just now said, that some university critics, including Dover Wilson, for example, have made some remarks about Shakespeare which do coincide more or less with my point of view, and Wilson Knight, whose books you may have heard of, is not exactly an academic, I don't think, but his books are all about what he calls Shakespeare's purgatorial pilgrims, which coincides exactly with the point of view which I'm taking here. That is his phrase, purgatorial pilgrims. Now, just to, as I did last time, just to remind you of the dates, how this play is situated compared with other plays. It's certainly one of Shakespeare's mature plays. And at the age of 30, it was at the age of 30 that he wrote A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1594. These dates are approximate, but more or less exact. And the following year, when he was 31, he wrote Romeo and Juliet. And those are two of his early plays which predict the greatness of what was to come. And I often think of Shakespeare in connection with someone that you'll be very surprised to hear who it is, namely Mozart. Those people would say they were totally different. But in fact, both of them developed gradually with the years, and practically all Mozart's greatest compositions were at the end of his life, towards the end of his life. Of course, he had much less time than Shakespeare. He died, I think I'm right in saying it, at the age of 35. Shakespeare was 54, I think, when he died. So Mozart had much less time. But the common idea about Mozart is not exact. If we compared, for example, Mendelssohn and Mozart, what they had written at the age of 17, there would be no comparison between the two. It's Mendelssohn who would be ranked as the greatest composer of the two. But when Mozart was 22, he did write the wonderful E minor piano and violin sonata, and soon after that, the A minor piano sonata, which are among his greatest pieces of writing already. But it was only later, and right down to the year of his death, that the very great compositions poured out of him. Now, Shakespeare was already 38 when he wrote Hamlet in 1602. Othello and Measure for Measure were written about 2 years later, when he was 40. The Tempest, his last great play, was written at the age 8 years later, at the age of 48. Now, each of Shakespeare's great plays is marvelously unique as a work of art, having its own particular perfume, just as each different fruit has its own special taste. But each great play has nonetheless the same message underlying the extreme outward differences. It is concerned with that which has always been the deepest concern of every truly serious member of every civilization, that we know of, except the modern one, which cannot be said to have any such members, since no truly serious man or woman would identify themselves with it or even admit its claim to civilization. That deepest concern, the way of regaining all that was lost at the fall of man, was known in the ancient Greco-Roman world as the mysteries. More precisely, the lesser mysteries and the greater mysteries, Mysteria Parva and Mysteria Magna. Now, the lesser mysteries are the theme of Dante's Inferno and Purgatorio. The greater mysteries are the theme of his Paradiso. And since right down to the end of the Middle Ages, the spiritual life was often spoken of in these classical terms, and we will use them here. Now, although in Shakespeare's mature plays the greater mysteries are never lost sight of, the drama itself is concerned with the mysteries of hell and purgatory. That is, with the discovery of all the hidden evil in the soul and the purification from that evil. Purification by which the lost state of human perfection is regained. And it is thus that in Dante's epic, the terrestrial paradise is situated at the top of the mountain of purgatory. The entry into that garden is the end of the lesser mysteries. The inscription at Apollo's temple at Delphi, Gnothi Seauton, know thyself, expresses an altogether universal principle. It is miraculously elliptical, and enfolds the whole way of the mysteries, because it is only by knowing one's individual self, that is, by passing through the lesser mysteries, that one can realize, through the greater mysteries, the true self, which is God. Thus, in Hinduism, the supreme reality is expressed by the word Atma, which means self. And the Sufis continually quote the saying of the Prophet of Islam, who knoweth himself, the same knoweth his Lord. And Eckhart quoted Origen as having said, the soul's quest of God cometh by self-observation. If she knew herself, she would know God also. To come now to our play, it is significant that the Duke of Vienna, who personifies human perfection in Measure for Measure, is described as one whose chief concern has always been to know himself. He presides over the whole play, as we shall see, like a spiritual master, keeping watch over souls who are novices upon the path of self-knowledge. And in this connection, let me say that I feel that the Duke in this play is one of the characters in all Shakespeare's writings which come nearest to him. The one who is usually singled out in that respect is, of course, Prospero in The Tempest. But the Duke of Vienna and Prospero have a very great deal in common. And the same applies to less principal characters like Edgar in King Lear, who guides his father, as it were, along the spiritual path to death and teaches him the virtue of resignation to the will of heaven. Now, in connection with self-knowledge, in passing, I'll just remind you that whereas the Duke of Vienna is described as one whose chief concern has always been to know himself, in the first scene of King Lear, with reference to the king himself, who is at that point no more than the novice of novices on the path of self-knowledge, it is said, "He hath ever but slenderly known himself." And in that drama of coming to know oneself, the theme of self-knowledge is highlighted by the inclusion of his daughters as part of himself. He says to Goneril, when he discovers something of what she is like, "Thou art my flesh, my blood, my daughter, or rather a disease that's in my flesh, which I must needs call mine. Thou art a boil, a plague sore, an embossed carbuncle in my corrupted blood." And of course his knowledge of Cordelia at the end of the play brings us to the edge of the greater mysteries. But I can't digress too much about other plays. We must keep to the one we are concentrating on. But first, I must still say something more by way of introduction. The mysteries are exceedingly dangerous. It has in fact been said of them that all else is child's play. Throughout historic times, they have been only for a few. As you know, referring to the many, Christ said to the few, that is his apostles, "Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but unto them it is not given." What are the dangers? And this is especially relevant to Measure for Measure. The fallen soul, which has to be perfected, is by definition both chaotic and fragmentary. Chaotic because many of the psychic elements are in the wrong place. Fragmentary because many of the elements are dormant and quite unknown to the ego in question. The novice is given by the mystical order into which he has been initiated, the sacramental means of putting everything in the right place, which involves, of course, waking up the dormant elements. The necessary qualifications for the path of the mysteries, is that there should be a sufficiency of rightly placed elements in the soul, because it is these who must operate the powers of the spirit in rectifying what is wrong. Even so, there is bound to be a struggle. And that is what was known in the Middle Ages as a holy war, both in Christianity and in Islam. That is the inner aspect of the holy war. There's a saying of the Prophet of Islam, "On return from a battle in the outer world, we have returned from the lesser holy war to the greater holy war." And when asked, "What is the greater holy war?" he said, "The war against the soul." And that is precisely what is in question here, and in Christianity too. I have a book of Christian saints, on Christian saints, which is entitled Warriors of God. And such orders as the Knights Templar in the Middle Ages were engaged in, they fought in the Crusades, they were engaged in outer warfare, but their main concern was inner warfare. The doctrine of original sin is universal. It means that the powers of darkness have a certain hold over every fallen soul. And like a predator with its prey, they may relax their hold to a certain extent if the prey does not try to escape. The fact that a fallen man who has practiced faithfully his religion will escape from them at death is beyond their ken. But the mysteries are concerned with escape here and now, total escape from the powers of darkness, which will do everything they can to prevent that escape. And their great opportunity is when one of the soul's hitherto dormant elements wakes up in a state of raging perversion and joins forces with the infernal powers against the powers of the spirit. And apart from such possibilities, the soul of the novice is not lacking in elements that are still more or less worldly, and others likewise not yet won over by the Spirit, which are indifferent and agnostic. All these are potential allies of the devil. But before considering now the relevance of these introductory remarks to Measure for Measure, the relevance to Measure for Measure, we should perhaps dwell on a very elliptical but nonetheless profound remark made by Mariana at the end of the play. She's pleading for the life of her husband, Angelo. And she says, "They say best men are molded out of faults, and for the most become much more the better for being a little bad. So may my husband." The meaning is that an apparently faultless man who is not complete owing to the presence of dormant elements in his soul is of far less value than a man who is complete but whose soul has many faults, because those elements which were dormant and are now awake have not yet had time to be put in their right place. Those of you who know the play well, and I expect most of you do, will realize that I'm referring here to Angelo in this play, because that is exactly what happens with him, to him. But there is no psychic element which is not potentially good, because after all, man was created perfect, and the psychic elements are passed on from generation to generation. They may be corrupted, but potentially they must be good. And to take an example relevant to this play, passion in itself is neutral. It is a power of the soul which may be put to good or bad use, clearly. And if involved in the things of this world, it can be iniquitous. But if turned towards the next world, passion and transformed into fervor, passion can be saintly. And it is a man of such fervor turned towards the next world, who is an example of what Mariana means here by best men that are molded out of faults, because the faults were those same elements of fervor before they were transformed into fervor and while they were still worldly. Now to the play itself. I'll just go through it briefly for the sake of those who are not very familiar with it, and those who are will excuse me for doing so. The Duke of Vienna decides to absent himself from his office for a while, and he appoints a man named Angelo to be his deputy, and invests him with all his own powers. But instead of going to Poland, as he has led them to believe, he simply goes to a friar's cell in Vienna and asks the friar to lend him a habit so that he may walk freely in disguise about the city and see for himself how things are. He gives the friar a reason for his decision. The laws of Venice are very strict, but for the last 14 years, he says, he has been too lenient in applying them. If now he suddenly enforces them, it will seem like tyranny, but a deputy has a certain duty to enforce the laws and can say in his own defense, I have no choice. Moreover, the growing corruption in Vienna demands this, and Angelo is a man much respected for his virtue, with a strictness and severity which makes him hard on himself as well as on others. He is clearly just the man for this task. But the Duke admits to the friar that he has other reasons for his decision, and one of them is to put Angelo to the test. He doesn't tell us what comes out later, and which he knows also very well, that Angelo was betrothed and even contracted to a lady named Mariana, whom I have just quoted, whose speech at the end of it I have just quoted, and the nuptials were about to be celebrated when her brother was killed in a shipwreck. Her brother was a great soldier who fought for Vienna. And her dowry was lost in the shipwreck. And on hearing this, Angelo immediately repudiated her, giving as an additional reason that it was said that she had a certain levity, for which there were no grounds. That is ugly in itself, and the Duke knew of this perfectly well. That may well have been another reason, but he does admit that. We shall see what seemers are by this, by seeing how Angelo behaves when he has power. Now, meantime, Angelo has decided to begin his rule by enforcing the laws against sexual corruption. The penalty for fornication is death, and he has ordered the arrest of a betrothed couple of good family on the grounds that the woman is expecting a child. The man, Claudio, is sentenced to death. Now, there is in this play a very unpleasant character who is described in the dramatis personae as a fantastic. I don't know what Shakespeare exactly meant by that, I have to confess. One of the editors describes the man as an unprincipled rake, and that fits fairly well, but it doesn't do justice to his unpleasantness. However, he seems to know everybody and may appear in almost any scene. And he's called Lucio, and he knows Claudio, and when Claudio and Juliet, his betrothed, with whom he is in love, are led through the streets by Angelo's order to humiliate them. And Lucio sees them, and Claudio asks him to go to his sister Isabella and tell her what has happened, and ask her to go to Angelo, the deputy, and plead for his life. The news comes to Isabella when she's at the convent of St. Clair in Vienna, talking to one of the nuns, because she herself aspires to enter this convent. And the first remark we hear her make is very significant. It is that she wishes that the rules of the order were more strict than they are. We see she has certain things in common with Angelo. She agrees to go to Angelo on behalf of her brother. But already the Lord Aeschylus, whom the Duke has left as second in command to Angelo, and who is a very good, reliable man, the right-hand man of the Duke himself, has been for years, and the Duke has left him with Angelo as second in command, and Aeschylus has pleaded with Angelo, but without any success, for the life of Claudio. Angelo says, "When I that censure him do so offend, let mine own judgment pattern out my death." Then he sends for the provost, who is in charge of the prison, and says, "See that Claudio be executed by 9 tomorrow morning. Bring him his confessor. Let him be prepared." Then you see how wonderful in dramatic situation this play is. Already Shakespeare has gripped his audience with these intense situations. Isabella comes to Angelo. Lucio, who brought her the message, is there at the same time, and the provost is also there, and they both encourage her with asides, telling her that she's not going at it strongly enough at first. And although she pleads at first rather lamely, she becomes increasingly eloquent. And Isabella is very beautiful. And while she is pleading, Angelo is gradually overcome with desire for her. The man who is considered a saint by most people, one of the strictest men in Vienna, is quite overcome. having insisted again and again in answer to her pleas that Claudio must die, he finally says he will think it over, I will bethink me, and tells her to come tomorrow, simply with the desire to see her again. Angelo, when he is left alone, when they have all gone out, gives us a long soliloquy, of which the gist is, never could the strumpet, with all her double vigour, art and nature, once stir my temper, but this virtuous maid subdues me quite. What dost thou, or what art thou, Angelo? Dost thou desire her foully for those things that make her good? O cunning enemy, that to catch a saint with saints dost bait thy hook. That, of course, is addressed to the devil, that last remark. O cunning enemy, that to catch a saint with saints dost bait thy hook. Now that remark is very significant in more than one way, because it shows that Angelo has become accustomed to thinking of himself as something of a saint. But it also shows that he is, that he has spiritual intentions. But it is also certain that if left to himself, if he had not been given this power that the Duke has given him, he would never have advanced upon the spiritual path. And the same may be said of Isabella also, if she had gone into her convent and probably become prioress in her turn and made the rules even stricter than they are, she would never have come to the end of the spiritual path. She would never have advanced upon the spiritual path. But according to the play's, even according to the play's literal meaning, in virtue of her intention to be a nun, Isabella is already on the path of the mistress. She comes to Angelo again as told the next day. And in a marvelously written scene, Angelo gradually comes to the point and is finally forced into bluntness by the fact that the truth is too incredible for Isabella to understand mere hints. But when the truth at last dawns, she cries out, I will proclaim thee, Angelo, look for it. Sign me a present pardon for my brother, or with an outstretched throat I'll tell the world aloud what man thou art. But Angelo simply replies, who will believe thee, Isabel? My unsoiled name, the austereness of my life, my vouch against you, and my place in the state, will so your accusation overweigh that you shall stifle in your own report the smell of calumny. I have begun, and now I give my sensual race the rein. Fit thy consent to my sharp appetite. Redeem thy brother by yielding up thy body to my will, or else he must not only die the death, but thy unkindness shall his death draw out in lingering sufferance. Answer me tomorrow, or by the affection that now guides me most, I'll prove a tyrant to him. As for you, say what you can. My false outweighs your true. He leaves her, and she sees that indeed no one would believe the truth if she told it. And she goes to tell her brother what has happened and that he must prepare for death. She has a great confidence in her brother. And she says, though he hath fallen by prompture of the blood, yet hath he in him such a mind of honour that had he 20 heads, he'd yield them up before his sister should her body stoop to such abhorred pollution. Then Isabel live chaste, and brother die. She goes to the prison, but already the Duke, disguised as a friar, and I must remind you that throughout all this part of the play, the Duke is always disguised. He is with Claudio, preparing him for death. There are three paths in this play. The path of Isabella, the path of Angelo, and the path of Claudio, who is condemned to death. And in each case, the Duke is the spiritual master. And Claudio's way is a very simple one. It is a question of being resigned to death, a young man becoming, in the fullness of life, becoming resigned to death. In this scene now, it is in this scene that when he questions Claudio about how he feels, and Claudio says to him, I have hope to live and am prepared to die. It is then that the Duke speaks his most famous lines, which begin, be absolute for death. Either death or life shall thereby be the sweeter. And at the end, Claudio says to him, I humbly thank you, and adds that he now sees that real life, the afterlife, is to be found in death. Then Isabella comes in, and the Duke tells the provost, who is in charge of the prison, to place him somewhere where he can hear what the brother and sister are saying to each other. Now, Isabella tells Claudio what Angelo has said, has demanded from her. And at first, Claudio says that she must not agree to save him in that way. But then, he is overcome by fear of death, and says, sweet sister, let me live. And Isabella turns on him in a fury, and she says, oh, you beast, oh, faithless coward, oh, dishonest wretch, die, perish, might but by bending down retrieve thee from thy fate. It should proceed. I'll pray 1,000 prayers for thy death, no word to save thee. He asks her to hear him, but she shouts him down, and at that moment the Duke comes in. The Duke has heard everything. He asks Isabella to wait for him, and he tells Claudio, he speaks then to Claudio alone, tells him not to entertain any false hopes. Tomorrow you must die. Go to your knees and make ready. And Claudio is altogether overcome with shame. He says, let me ask my sister pardon. I am so out of love with life that I will sue to be rid of it. And the Duke tells him, hold you there. Left alone with Isabella, he does not comment on her outburst of anger with her brother, but it becomes quite clear by the end of the play that although he would not have been in favor of her agreeing to Angelo's request, Angelo's demand in order to save her brother, he is aware of the hardness in Isabella which caused her to say, I'll pray 1,000 prayers for thy death and not one word to save thee. But at the moment he tells her that he knows all that Angelo has said to her, and he has a plan by which he can save her brother, he can save her brother's life, and she will not be required to do herself any dishonor. He tells her that Angelo was betrothed to Mariana, and that he had repudiated her because of her lost dowry. And he tells Isabella to go to Angelo at the time he mentioned, answer his requiring with a plausible obedience, agree with his demands, but he tells her to make the condition that her stay with him shall not be long, and that all shall be in darkness and in silence. He says he will tell Mariana to go to Angelo at the appointed time in place of Isabella, and Isabella agrees to this. The prison where so much of this action takes place is an apt setting for the descent into hell. Nor is Claudio's arrest the only one since Angelo's regime began, as we can imagine. There has been an influx of lechers, brothel keepers, harlots, etc. The scenes in question provide a certain comic relief and seem to take place during visiting hours, because there seems to be not much impediment for anybody to walk into prison. And from another point of view, what one doesn't expect in a prison, one of the prisoners, who is described in the dramatis personae as the servant to a board, is roped in to be assistant executioner, because they're short of the second executioner, and there's a certain laxity about the whole question. And this particularly unpleasant character, Lucio, whom I mentioned before, is nearly always present talking to these disreputable people whom he knows, and also talking to the Duke and to the Provost. And to the Duke asks him what sort of man the Duke was, the Duke is, the Duke disguised, of course, as always, and Lucio gives him a very bad report.
In fact, he speaks considerable calumnies against the Duke. But these sordid scenes are very apt, as it were, as a background to Shakespeare's Inferno, which this play is.
And in this connection, I should say that, I should mention that although in Dante's epic the Inferno and the Purgatorio are quite separate, in Shakespeare's plays they are usually simultaneous, and in fact they are usually simultaneous, because knowledge of evil is accompanied by purification from evil. You cannot, for example, in King Lear, separate hell from purgatory, or in Antony and Cleopatra, or in Cymbeline, or in fact most of Shakespeare's plays, but they are absolutely separate in The Winter's Tale. And for Angelo, at least, they are completely separate in this play. And in Othello, they are completely separate. Othello goes down to the bottom of hell until the truth is suddenly revealed in the last scene, and it lights up his whole journey, and he goes through purgatory in a few minutes. But a purgatory so intense that it is altogether convincing. And as we shall see, the same thing applies to Angelo in this play. In The Winter's Tale, as we saw last time, Leontes' purgatory takes place in the 16 years which elapse between the two parts of the play. It is not on the stage. But it could have been that at the moment of hearing the truth of the oracle and of the death of his son and his wife, it could have been made by Shakespeare an instantaneous purgatory, as in this play. But normally, as I say, the two are simultaneous, purgatory and hell, the getting to know one's hidden evils and the purification from those evils. Now, in this prison, there is another prisoner sentenced to death for murder. And he's been in the prison for 9 years. And when the Duke asks the Provost, why is this? Why did the Duke allow this? The Provost replies that there were always appeals against his death penalty by his friends, and the thing has dragged on, but Angelo has now decided that he should be put to death. And his execution warrant has just arrived at the prison together with Claudio's. Claudio is to die at 8 o'clock the next morning. It is now midnight, and the Duke assures the Provost that a reprieve for Claudio is about to come. The Provost is dubious about this, but the Duke assures him it is the case. And finally, a messenger arrives from Angelo, and the Duke is almost triumphant. But when the provost reads out the message, it is this: whatsoever you may hear to the contrary, let Claudio be executed by 4 o'clock, and in the afternoon Barnardine is the other man, for my better satisfaction, let me have Claudio's head sent me by 5. The Duke is amazed, but not defeated. There is a certain, one has to confess, there is a certain grim humour in some of these scenes. He persuades the provost to have Barnardine, the murderer, executed first, and his head sent to Angelo as Claudio's. The provost objects that Angelo has seen both people, and he will see that it is not Claudio's head. But the Duke replies, death's a great disguiser, and you may add to it, shave the head and trim the beard, and say it was the desire of the penitent to be so bared before his death. The course is common. It was common for people to shave their heads, apparently, at death, or have their heads shaved at death. But again the Duke is thwarted. He goes to prepare Barnardine for death and finds him, as he says, quite unfit to die. It would be damnable to put him to death, the Duke says, in the present frame of mind that he is in. He's most of the time he is drunk. Seems strange that prisoners in a prison should be able to get enough drink whenever they want it in order to be drunk, but according to the play, Barnardine spends most of his time drunk, the rest of his time asleep. He doesn't appear to believe in the next world at all, and when summoned to execution, he always refuses to come. That's why they roped in the second man to be an assistant executioner. But the Duke says it's out of the question to put this man to death. But it so happens that a young man had just died in the prison, a man much more like Claudio than Barnardine to look at, of the same age and the same colour of hair. And so the provost has this dead man's head cut off, and that is sent to Angelo, and nobody is executed. But when Isabella arrives at the prison to make sure that her brother has been reprieved, the Duke tells her that he has been put to death and that his head has been sent to Claudio, to Angelo. He also tells her that the Duke is returning to Vienna the next day, and that she must accost him in the street at the time of his procession when he arrives, and accuse Angelo before him in public. But he insists that she shall accuse him of what Angelo believes to be true, namely, that she allowed him to deflower her on condition that he would reprieve her brother. Isabella reluctantly agrees to this. We see that this is one example of a measure for measure that the Duke makes Isabella suffer. She does what he says, and her accusation comes to nothing. And then, as arranged by the Duke, Mariana comes forward and tells the truth of what happened. Angelo denies everything, and the Duke seems to believe him. A friar who is present, Friar Peter, says that it was a certain Friar Lodovic, and that is the name taken by the Duke in disguise, who set the women on. And the Duke orders that Friar Lodovic be sent for. And he himself goes out, saying that he will leave this case to the judgment of Angelo and Aeschylus. And then the Duke is fetched in, disguised as Friar Lodovic. And he supports the two women and accuses Angelo himself. And Aeschylus, of course, supports Angelo, and the two of them are highly indignant. And then Lucio accuses the Duke of having slandered the Duke. Instead, it was he himself that slandered the Duke to the Duke, but now he accuses the Duke of having slandered the Duke in disguise. And Angelo and Aeschylus order the arrest of Friar Lodovic. And Lucio goes to help with the arrest and pulls off the friar's hood, revealing the Duke in his true identity. And the Duke takes the place on the dais of Angelo, to whom he says, "Sir, by your leave, hast thou or word or wit or impudence that yet can do thee office?" But Angelo sees that the Duke knows everything, as he says, like power divine, and he just begs to be put to death. "No longer session hold upon my shame, but let my trial be mine own confession. Immediate sentence, then, and sequent death is all the grace I beg." That is Angelo's Purgatorio, and we are quite convinced that it is altogether sincere, and that Angelo is a full man. He has no longer any unknown dormant elements asleep in his soul, and those elements which almost caused his soul to be lost, and would have done, no doubt, but for the intervention of the spiritual master, who is the Duke. The actual discovery of the truth has, one feels, purified him. And what has happened explains the words of Mariana, which I quoted before. The Duke doesn't answer this speech of Angelo. He simply sends for Mariana. He calls Mariana to come forward and says to Angelo, were you contracted to this woman? And Angelo says, "I was, my lord." And then he sends him out with Mariana and tells the friar to marry them at once and bring them back. And on the return he says to Angelo, "We do condemn thee to the very block where Claudio stooped to death. And with like haste, away with him And then, it is then that Mariana pleads for her husband. And the Duke is adamant. He insists repeatedly he dies for Claudia's death. Then Mariana calls to Isabel and asks her to join her in pleading for Angelo. And Isabella is silent. And the Duke tells Mariana, it is out of all reason that you ask Isabella, who has been so wronged, so terribly wronged, to plead for Angelo. How could you expect her to plead for him? But then Mariana asks again, and again Isabella is silent, and again the Duke enlarges on the absurdity of asking Isabella to plead. And then finally, Isabella kneels beside Mariana, and she makes a very powerful plea, a very reasonable plea for Angelo to be spared, saying that she believes that he was intentionally a good man until all these things overcame him. But the Duke still insists he dies for Claudio's death. And then the provost comes forward and says that in secret he kept Claudio alive, and he brings Claudio onto the stage, who is still alive. And the Duke takes Isabella by the hand and says, give me your hand and say you will be mine. And that is the end. And that ending is somewhat, on the face of the text, somewhat unexpected, because the Duke, of course, has always been with Isabella as disguised as a friar, giving her advice for this and that. But nonetheless, it is up to actors to show a certain strong attraction between the two persons, simply as characters. But one feels, as when one sees the play, that this is just right, and that Isabella will be a perfect Duchess of Vienna and a wonderful companion to the Duke. And of course, according to the deeper meaning of the play, since the Duke is, as Angelo says, power divine, this is, one might say, or their marriage will be the beginning of the greater mysteries, that is, the union of the soul with the divine spirit. The same may apply to Angelo and Mariana, because Mariana is presented in this play as a very saintly woman who has remained all these years faithful to Angelo. And the Duke says to Angelo at the end, after this has happened, love her, Angelo, I have confessed her, and I know her worth. And as to the other little path, the path of Claudio, which takes the form of complete resignation to death, you can say that that marriage is marriage with Juliet, which takes place now at the end of the play, may be said to bask in the sun of the two other marriages. But you have in this play these three paths, the one of Claudio's of less importance, but nonetheless very profound, because to come to terms with death when one is young, in the way that Claudio does, to be completely resigned to death, is already a passage through the lesser mysteries, one might say. And he has discovered, he learns in the passage, the weakness, the unknown weakness in his soul, when he begs his sister to nonetheless let him live and to sacrifice her honour for his sake. But Isabel is purified of her hard streak, and one feels that at the end of the play she has reached perfection. And the same with Angelo, strange though it may seem. Now, I don't know what the time is. Oh, yes, I have gone on well over the time, so I think that will have to do for this evening.